Turning to section 16 of the Legal Commission, turning to Jardine Family Trust and Remarkable Station rezoning request out at Jack's Point. So Council's position is set out there at 16.1, and the absence of sufficient evidence from Jardine relating to wastewater disposal and the transportation effects of significantly increasing the development capacity of Homestead Bay, which includes new accesses to the state highway. Ms. Jones and the council has only recommended a small rezoning of rural land to Jack's Point zone and minor changes to the structure plan and provision. I think it's worth noting that if Ms. Jones has gone to some length, I guess, to indicate her recommendations in terms of changes to the structure plan and provision that would be required if Jardine could provide sufficient evidence relating to wastewater disposal issues and transport effects. She did that in a section 42A report, but then in rebuttal evidence, her evidence is that she's still not comfortable with the level of evidence that's been provided. There is a further submission from the Gap Point Residents and Owners Association. They support Jardine and their further submission, subject to some requirements to the structure plan and provisions in the Jack's Point zone. The Residents and Owners Association has sought leave to present state evidence, and Council for the Owners Association has asserted the committee raising the evidence for all raised in the wording of the third submission.
Could I just clarify what you're on about there? Because I thought it's just one that I dealt with last week, where that was actually in relation to raise evidence and amendments to the previous submission in relation to the Conan site. Is this different?
I think it is different.
I don't recall seeing
So the Owners Estate Association has filed rebuttal. Well, they have filed evidence,
right,
which was received at the time of rebuttal evidence rather than the submitted evidence stage,
but
that is in the process. And it raises a number of concerns with the Jardine Commission.
Right.
And the evidence has come in a little bit late in the piece, but it has been framed as rebuttal evidence. Some of it possibly goes a little bit further than
rebuttal
evidence. But that is something that I'm sure you will I think there is a little bit of confusion between Jack's Point interests, but this is related to the Jack's Point zone. So Mr. Ferguson's evidence outlines the Owners Association's four key concerns as being one, the potential increase in traffic from Homestead Bay through Jack's Point and integration with the zone's growing network. Number two, integration and capacity of new private infrastructure with the existing Jack's Point zone infrastructure, and the water quality, landscape and visual effects of new infrastructure, including the potential new water reservoir on Jack's Point. Three, visual effects on the state highway along the Homestead Bay portion, and finally, the inclusion and integration of the Skylake head strip into the Jack's Point zone, and more particularly within the Owensdale activity area on the structure plan, together with identification of vehicle access. So as mentioned, the council's position is generally aligned with the concerns set out by Mr. Ferguson, and as I just mentioned as well, Mr. Jones has been clear that if Jardine was able to demonstrate at the hearing, first of all, it was for evidence, but at the hearing, that the expansion and intensification as sought can be serviced, and track of effects avoided or mitigated, then she will consider recommending the provisional recommendations that she set out in her evidence in chief, as well as the modifications to address additional concerns raised in her evidence. And she'll take these through that into the summary.
Well, that just foreshadows something. She's getting Dr. Child as evidence, and Ms. Jones doesn't seem to deal with it at all.
I believe she has taken into account. So, what Dr. Child's evidence does explain is that there is the existing SkyDive operation out at Jack's Point, and there are no, essentially it has a consent, it has an existing consent, but it doesn't have model noise controls like the Queenstown Airport does. However, the same or similar issues are relevant in terms of reverse sensitivity. So the effect if you put residential zoning with a close proximity to the end zone operation. So Ms. Jones has taken Dr. Charles' evidence into account in terms of taking his recommendation to not change the zoning or the activity area within a certain area to residential.
Yes. Right. I was wondering how she was able to do that without actually seeing the detailed information that you'd need in terms of conjuring.
Yes, and Dr. Charles, he has raised those concerns. He said, well, we don't have that information. It's not available from the previous recent direct referral from 3 or 4 years ago that was ultimately declined in terms of expanding those operations. But Dr. Charles said, well, the information hasn't been provided, but this is based on the information that was available in that consenting hearing, saying that this area is an issue. Ultimately, there's a further issue with the SDS strip, and that ultimately, if there's a recommendation from the Jardine Board, it could stay rural, but that would ultimately mean it would be surrounded on four sides by Jack's Point Zone, which then would be stopped as rural that is for people. Okay, turning to Queenstown Park Commission, for that sort of new Queenstown Park Special Zone, which includes a gondola corridor, which is extends from the operative plan Remarkables Park on Frankton, along the Kara River and then up to the Remarkables ski field. Mr. Buxton in Section 42A report and rebuttal has recommended rejecting this submission, principally because he considers his proposed rezoning would have significant adverse landscape effects. Ms. Malthoff's landscape evidence will be called on Monday, 4th of September. There has been a concern raised about the use of the Queenstown Park through the submission to possibly expand on the location of the proposed on the corridor. So the primary submission included a general location of the proposed corridor, but it was lacking in detail and technical scale. Subsequently, a revised submission was provided, which was then notified for the submission. And then a further submission by Remarkables Park and QBL then thought that consideration should be given to either rezoning the corridor or another mechanism such as an overlay. And that further submission included a plan with an amendment to the gondola corridor alignment. This raises an issue around the use of further submission to alter the original submission. The council's position on this is that further submission can only be made with support of or opposition to submissions already made, and further submission cannot extend the scope of the original submission and can only seek allowance or disallowance in whole or part of the original submission. However, in any event, the minor amendments opposed to the gondola corridor are not opposed because council considers that they essentially fall within the scope of the primary submission and it's essentially alignment of QPL's relief. They could have, for example, provided that refinement through the evidence, but they chose to do it through a further submission. So, although the submission is strictly procedurally not the correct way to go, council's position is that evidence could, that information could come by evidence anyway. There is an issue as to, or possible issue in terms of the use of comprehensive development plans, in terms of a couple of the rules from the proposed special zone. Council for QPL and RPL has addressed the use of comprehensive development plans in his legal submission that has been filed, and these are accepted as submissions. I think it's just relevant to note that Mr. Buxton has recommended rejecting this commission on other grounds, but if the official zone rules to be recommended, care will need to be taken in drafting those particular rules. I've already taken you through paragraph 17.8, so I will not do that again. Turning to the Loch Linney submission, Mr. Eastby's evidence. He amends the area that the submission thought to be either rezoned to a farm-based area or a rural visitor zone. And in response to Mr. Eastby's evidence, Mr. Buxton has addressed the revised area on its merits in his rebuttal evidence. However, the revised area does go beyond the area of land identified in the original map attached to Loch Linney's original submission, which creates a jurisdictional issue. At the time of filing these submissions, no legal submission supporting the scope of the revised release has been provided. We expect they will likely come and we'll consider them in our replies if needed. Turning to the Gibson Valley Station submission. So the Gibson Valley Station has requested that its properties be rezoned from rural and from Gibson character zone to a subzone, providing for a range of uses, including residential, agriculture, commercial, business accommodation, and commercial recreation. Mr. Buxton, in his Section 42A report, has recommended rejecting the rezoning on the basis that it would allow a significant increase from the already consented development on the site and would create urbanisation that would erode the distinctive character of the Gibson Valley. Through his rebuttal evidence, Mr. Buxton maintained that recommendation, noting that it is unclear what the proposed subzone would provide for and how the proposed rules would fit within the proposed plan Gibson character zone. Mr. Buxton considers that the proposed subzone goes beyond being complementary to the Gibson character zone and will create development where the rural landscape will become less dominant and possibly the leisure element within the subzone. Council's expert landscape witness for that submission, Dr. Reed, is also opposed to the rezoning because the proposed revisions are too broad and uncertain to ensure that the development and portrayed and submitted evidence will be realised without adverse effects on the broader landscape or visual impact. Again, here there is a possible issue in terms of the rules relating to an outline development plan. Again, I just refer to Mr. Young's submission, which covers the same question as the FIRAs of these types of rules. They can be appropriately drafted. The consent needs to be for a specific activity rather than a consent for the plan itself. And again, in this instance, that's not the reason why this particular zone or subzone is recommended to be rejected. I do note that there was some additional material filed late last week, an amended structure plan, and some more changes to chapters 23 and 27. I understand that the committee was granted extension for the time of filing legal submission. I'm not aware if they had sought or received leave to file amended evidence, nor did the legal address whether it's scope for the amended release. No doubt that will be contacted hearing. I just wish to add or point out in relation to those legal submissions, they do address the 2008 consent. And council reserves its position as to whether the 2008 consent should be considered as part of the existing requirement, given the legal submissions suggest that the consent will not be implemented. So that's an issue that popped up late last week, and will require a bit of consideration.
Mr. Chair, would you please explain to me how the existing environment is considered in the plan? This is a new one on me. Do a quick summary and I'll get a briefing.
Yes, so this is the issue of the
Hawthorne is the scene of violence concept, which is of course a setting concept. And the question is how it applies to a district plan. So council has given submissions essentially accepting and case law authority supports that the concept can be applied in the plan change or in a district plan review context. The question of course is whether and it needs to be, there needs to be evidence that it will be prepared and that is my concern with Gibson's legal submission because that's suggesting that they don't want to implement the consent, which raises issues as to whether they can form part of the environment. The question then is though, well, the situation that is arising in some submissions around the district is that part of a consent may have been implemented and a submission may be looking to essentially encapsulate that the rest of the consent into the new zone type. So the existing environment concept needs to be treated with care as to whether an entire consent does or will be implemented and therefore can be considered to form part of the existing environment.
Thank you.
Can you remind me when you made those sections? I remember that was the scary
thing.
Yes. Right.
So finally, in relation to Gibson, Gibson Valley, there is a small issue I think related to the EPS. The submitter filed a memorandum in late June seeking clarification from the panel in relation to whether the state supplementary evidence regarding growing capacity had any bearing on their submission points. The legal submission to the submitter asserted that this is a point to be set aside and that the state's reference to the Christian character going ahead to be oversight. In short, this is related to the consideration of growing capacity within the entire ward and then the more focused analysis of what's going to be getting growth standards. So the submitter is quite rightly correct in terms of it's not relevant to within the growth standards, but in terms of the analysis of the ward and the district as a whole, it does have some relevance.
Thank you.
Thank turning to the submission of Mark Bass, number 8811, this submitter sought the removal of the proposed stage 1 middle accommodation subzone over the Marshall County Lodge, which is also known as the rural lifestyle zone. So this is a middle accommodation subzone that hasn't been withdrawn through the process, it's one that remains.
I was going to say that we dealt with this in spring two,
yes.
And we heard from all the submitters and further submitters at that point.
I don't think anything
new was added by Mr. Buxton on what you've said here.
Fantastic. Well, I might just propose that then.
Yes.
There's just a bit of confusion there as to the suggestion of the two options
I'm just minded that I've written the report on that one. That's why it's for you.
Look, that brings me to the end of my written submission. There was a question earlier on about the relevance of future conservation orders.
Yes.
So in Appendix 1, the extract from Carly or Vinyard, under subfloor A5, section 75.4 of the RMA, the district plan, I've got the consultation order. And I believe Mr. Buxton put into a contract with the council with conversation on it. And then as well as having those requests on part through notice of mission.
What I was going to ask you about is the recent decision of the Environment Court. Southern Fishing Game and Southern Regional Council and Southern District Council,
mm-hmm.
and that's 2017-220, where it seems that the Environment Court's conclusions were based on the reasons the water conservation order was applied rather than the terms of the order itself. And it was to do with the effects on the amenity effects of a land use activity on the use of the, well, for there it was fishing, was the primary purpose for fishing. And I'm just wondering whether that is, we should be looking rather wider than just the actual terms of the order given that.
Yes, I have seen that case come through. I haven't read it with that in mind, but I will do that this evening. The Environment Court decision is obviously not binding on your recommendation, but I will take a look at that decision and see how it is in the
house. Yes, but it would be useful if you give us some guidance on that.
Yes.
It is obviously relevant to the Queensland Park, for instance.
Yes.
Do you have any other questions? I've got just a couple more. With the O&L lines, do they have any significant when they're on land that is unzoned in the proposed plan?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly there's adjoining the Martin Park, large portion of unformed road, which of course has no zoning on it, and the line runs through the middle of it. It would be useful to have the council's view on whether that actually has any effect on that.
Yes, I think that's probably something that I'd be responding to
and
reply and writing, just to add.
But it may be
not
the
only place in
Commissioner Robinson tells me there's a similar place in Albertown, similar situation.
Yes, and well, there are also some in roads within our house.
For example, going to the Remarkable. And so I don't think it's a one-off, but I'm happy to read that comment when the council's advice. I know this is really a, presumably a confirmation, but as I understand it, if the solution to the zoning request is actually a text change, we would have scope to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. Now there's an issue with, and it came up in, would have been Ms. Evans' Section 42A report, I think, with the entertainment precinct. And the extension of it in Queenstown Town Centre Zone. She's talked about the water pipe investment submission, which is number 549, and says it was dealt with in Stream 8, but in fact, I checked Stream 8 and we only dealt with the supporting the subzone, not all the other parts of the submission. So it might be worth checking that we've actually paid another and dreaming of this dealt with.
Yes. Certainly we'll check that. I think the issue here in terms of scope, is reasonably wide in terms of the area, so
yes.
The county evidence I would anticipate on any particular commission point.
Yes, I think that's there. It's just a matter of making sure that. Well, not just that, but in fact, that they've been able to hear it.
Yes.
If we were to conclude that a rezoning is appropriate in any particular instance, should we focus on rezoning all sites, or is the council only concerned with partial site rezoning? And I raise this because of the definition of site, saying that split zoning essentially creates two sites.
Considers the area to kind of function as a whole rather than focusing on the pedestrian boundaries possibly in terms of what is a site or otherwise. I would prefer to answer that question in the context of this rezoning submission. Perhaps if you've got some examples there, I can look at them.
No, I haven't, but it may well come up in the question during the hearing. So I presume that this bank is going to suffer the next 7 weeks. So probably make a motion.
Yes, and I will just pass a note on to the other planners to think about that in the context of the particular recommendation.
Okay. Now, and then the final thing was, I was going to ask if you could get Miss Banks to prepare us a map. She started to, in her rebuttal, have a map of Franklin North area. And she has the out of control boundary shown and a 50 metre setback over that area. It would be very useful for the panel if we could have a scaled version of, say, A3, just 100 metre off, that could show both of those things as well as the setback from the Transpower lines. There's a National Grid Yard, I think it is.
Yes.
And really, O&L line ones, and it would be nice if there were contours, because that's
it is
relevant in that particular instance, and whatever it is that the government suggested, they'll provide some funding for could be in light grey underneath it all, perhaps.
Yes, we can. Then we manage to get to the
finally, so
we just ran out of time.
No, that's okay.
But we can do that.
It would be helpful to get that before we got to her 1A summary.
Okay. That's fine. And just on the relevance of the infrastructure fund, Mr. Bresner has some information on that. He can explain to you on the screen if you wish. I'll leave it.
Okay.
So, that is the end of the question. We will now turn to what we're here for, which is the evidence. My order is already out of date. Despite my best endeavours, we're going to ask the authority agency about this.
Thank you. I have provided evidence to Queenstown Lakes District Council in relation to economic matters regarding rezoning the dwelling capacity in the Queenstown area of the district, and in relation to commercial office activities, being commercial activities that take place in professional offices and industrial activities. The Queenstown Lakes housing market has seen significant and rapid changes over the past 10 years. These changes have resulted in substantial shifts in the affordability of homes in the district, as well as important impacts on community well-being and the cost of living and working. The district currently has the highest nominal average house price and the highest growth rate in the country. While the residential growth rate in Auckland has subdued over the past 12 months, the district has not experienced the same temporary growth. With an average house price of over 1.05 million, the level of affordability has resulted in home ownership levels across all households of only 35% and only 8% for those under 40 years. It is estimated that over the past 15 years, residential housing demand in the district rose by nearly 7,000 homes, while the corresponding supply fell short by over 1,000. This latent demand is currently playing its role in the ongoing pressure on house prices and affordability. Since 2006, the district has experienced the largest fall in home ownership rates across the country, with an average mortgage accounting for over 50% of the average after-tax income. A key component of the property market in the district is the number of vacant site transactions. These are not only high in terms of quantum, but also in terms of the number of transactions to property. This would indicate a significant market in land speculation. Queenstown, in reference to the Waikato Ward, makes up approximately 52% of the district's existing dwellings, with just over 10,500 in 2013. As indicated by the changing home ownership and affordability rates, an increasing proportion of this demand will be required in the lower price and income brackets. It is fundamental in terms of economic well-being that the PDP considers the changing residential environment in the district. The district has the opportunity to address the issues of affordability and built supply through the increased provision of medium and high density residential development in central locations. Property Economics have undertaken development of a feasibility model to advance the enabled capacity for residential dwellings provided by the council. This feasibility modelling was undertaken to understand if there is sufficient enabled capacity for sites in the district when considering the likelihood of the market to undertake development at a given profit margin. Several assumptions and market variables were considered in this model, and these were outlined in my evidence for both this hearing and the upcoming hearing stream. As a result, in total, the planned enabled capacity resulted in just over 27,000 dwellings, excluding the SAJs, within the Waikato area, with just under 20,500 of these being deemed feasible. It was important to reflect in the final numbers the potential for variances from the market averages that were applied at a site-by-site basis, given the development chance that would factor into the realisation of built form from the feasible development potential. As indicated above, the land market in which Waikato operates has factors associated with it that would indicate a proportionally high level of land speculation. This factor, coupled with the level of areas which with the level of areas which identify capacity, would alter this development chance, especially in the short to medium term. And so a high rate was applied of 50% for the modelled capacity. The final capacity resulting from the modelled parameters for Waikato was just over 15,000 dwellings. The table below from my second statement of evidence identifies the areas in which this capacity lies. In considering the sufficiency of this capacity, it is appropriate to have regard to future residential dwelling demand within the Waikato area beyond the period of the PDP. which would require just over 3,300 dwellings. As identified, the projected dwelling demand for Waikatipu to 2048 is expected to be approximately 9,500 dwellings, including the latent demand of 800 dwellings. When considering the modelled areas and areas identified by council, it is expected that even with a modelled development chance of 50%, there is more than sufficient capacity at just over 15,000 dwellings. Additionally, if the model applied at 15% long-term margin, as directed by the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity, it would result in a realisable capacity of a further 1,400 dwellings, or nearly a 10% increase in overall capacity. It may well be a good place to stop just to ask questions potentially on residential development capacity.
I've got a paradox that I'd like to understand, and it begins with the latent demand, which is unmet demand, in a market which appears to have an excessive supply, because not only is there speculation, but it appears to me that the president has pandered to that by amazing a huge amount of capacity. So I would like you to explain to me how there can still be latent demand when there's such a huge supply.
That's a very important point. That's absolutely right.
I continue to think the redundancy into the model to account for a lot of things, but was that fundamental? One of the key points and one of the key differences
or screens that we found in the Queenstown market was the speculation of residential land. And what that's resulted in, to a degree, is the lack of appropriate built form. And what that means is that there is a demand for housing that isn't being provided by the market for two reasons. That is that the land that is there isn't necessarily going to produce the demand that currently sits unmet. And the second one is that built form actually isn't being produced to meet that demand either. So there is a significant level of residential land and residential sites. Those are being traded rather than being built on. Mm. So essentially what we find in this market is that at an individual level, people are bought into these sections with potentially the intent of building, but with the significant increase in capital value, people have actually ended up selling those later down than actually building on them. And that's perpetuating it itself to a certain degree, whereas where you have a certain degree of the market that is actually simply sitting on these sites waiting for them to go up. And it's become an investment opportunity for a proportion of the market rather than something that is going to produce a functional dwelling.
So what you're saying is that it's not a problem that planning can solve. I think what you're saying to us that it's a problem that some other mechanism outside of the council has to solve. Is that it?
I think there are probably two aspects of it. I think you're right to a degree. The market has to be convinced that it is an appropriate risk to actually build dwellings on this land. At the same time, I think that that impetus is provided as well by the council directing for redevelopment of existing buildings. You're unlikely to get removal of buildings and simply the retention of an empty site. So the more the council can facilitate redevelopment in appropriate areas, the more built form you're actually going to get. And once you have that built form at an appropriate level, it's going to create a catalyst for the rest of the market, because simply you don't have that built up demand anymore, and you don't have that pressure of land values that then accentuates the motivation for people to buy and hold. If you can actually get buildings being built, whether they're in locations that have new sites, or whether it's redevelopment, if you can get buildings being built, there's less pressure on the market to drive that speculative land demand. So there is a role for the council in this, but the market has to be convinced that that's actually going to occur.
How does the council actually do that sort of facilitation? If it's more profitable for people to hang on to developable land?
Make it less profitable for them to hang on to it. So what you do is you actually start meeting that need through the redevelopment of the existing stock, which takes away that catalyst to drive the prices up. So you actually, instead of having this latent demand that sits there unmet, you actually provide it through redevelopment of more medium and high density.
So you're saying the council should become a property developer?
No, I think that the council should facilitate property development in appropriate locations. I don't think the council should be involved in making those
aren't you going to hit the same problem here? Whatever they try to facilitate, it's still going to be more profitable if they're not going to live.
Well, in terms of redevelopment, you're more likely to see redevelopment when those prices are high. So in the current market in Queenstown, you're more likely to see redevelopment facilitated by the zoning. That is, if you can get more and more built forward.
Presumably you're talking about upzoning to higher densities?
Upzoning anyway, yes.
Can I then follow up? The latent demand is for houses?
Latent demand is for houses.
Regular houses rather than townhouses and the stuff that you get in the medium and high
density. It's for the accommodation of an appropriate household. So there's 800 households that in the Queensdale market currently can't find somewhere that they would buy and live in essentially. So what we're talking about is a latent demand for a built product, whether that be apartment, townhouse, or houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I was wondering about family types and household types in an area with so many visitors and students and transients and all that, and how that would fit together.
And so that latent demand can be met at a greater proportion than the general market with a higher density product. Shifts within the market anyway, but then we will shift from a standalone property into something that's like an outhouse.
How do you come up with a figure of 800? It's probably the end of it.
There's several figures from 800 to 1,000 to 1,200 to 700.
So we've got a range originally between 800 and 1,200. The 800 is specific to the Wapitibu area, and the remaining 200, roughly 200. Falls in the Wanaka ward. The way that we look at that is we look at the average growth in household numbers over a period of time, and we look at how many houses were actually developed to meet that demand. And then we factor in a certain degree, depending on the demographic structure in the area, we look at how the propensity for more than one household to be as well. So in some areas there may seem to be a lack of houses, but it may simply be that particular culture has a higher propensity to have two households in one dwelling. So we look at that sort of makeup as well. And then you see roughly how many in terms of growth of those households, whether the development of houses met that growth over that period of time.
Struggle. 50% factor of being conservative is in fact not conservative at all with what's going on.
I think in terms of a long-term development, I think short-term there are a lot of external factors that are causing a degree of market failure in Queenstown. Over the long-term, we expect those to start to even out. One of the reasons why we haven't broken this demand down into short periods of time and dealt really with the long-term 2048 demand is because of those factors that currently exist in the market. And those are some things that international factors, drivers from walking, for example, there's been a bigger propensity for people to against a rising Auckland house price and buy in something like Queenstown. So it's sort of a big movement of capital to Queenstown from equity in Auckland. And you find that in a lot of places around the country, but it's happened, around the settlement, it's happened in Queenstown quite a bit, where you have people buy in a second cycle of dwelling based on the equity that they hold in Auckland. Mm-hmm. And that, to a degree, has driven the price in Queenstown. And we're finding now that in the provincial areas, such as Hamilton and Tauranga, the tempering of the market in Auckland is causing almost an immediate effect. We'd expect to see that over the medium to long term in Queenstown as
well. Well, Queenstown might almost be attractive on the international market.
It has been very, very attractive. Again, one of the things that we're finding, one of the things that we're expecting over the next 2.5 to 3 years is a change in those international interest rates. And once we start to see those rise proportionally to New Zealand rates, we can expect to see that international investment, speculative of international investment, fall off.
Some markets where there's a shortage of supply and labour demand aren't met, the solution is to increase supply. And here you have supply at a price, but just and labour demand and the solution is still increased supply. To me, the plan at the moment enables a lot of development, considering that these figures don't include the FHA, they don't include flats, for example. How much more than, shall we say, the realizable capacity you need, and how much time do you need to address the problem of funding mix-up between, or the behaviour of speculation, shall we put it like
that? I think the time is probably a key factor in that.
Yeah.
I think you still see a degree of behaviour that isn't conducive to meeting that latent demand over the short to medium term, over the next sort of 18 months to 2 years, you'll still see that filter its way through the system. And some of those exogenous factors change, such as international interest rates, and crisis, and so forth. I think you will find that the market will, from the very calm itself down, and that capital will find its way through here. They're more likely to, there is a demand, let's say there is a demand there, and there is more likely to be a demand. It's less likely to be an investment opportunity at that point, simply because the rent capital is less than 2%, essentially at the moment. It's very, very low. So you're more likely to have residential buyers, owner occupiers coming in than investment.
I'm interested in your table. And I'm just wondering why in the areas where you've got zoned areas, you've relied on the feasible capacity rather than a discounting.
This is the second part of the
yes.
Table. Absolutely. So one of the things that we considered, one of the things that the council considered is rather than second guessing developers and what they would like to produce, consultation took place between the council and developers and the likely outcome for these particular areas. And rather than us going through, that's why the 50% translates to a 22% across the board, rather than us saying, no, you're not going to get what you're saying you're going to get, we provided that and then discounted the entire table at that rate. So that's why the 50% of the model capacity we knew would come out at more than the 15% required by the MPS. It came out at 22% across the board. So these numbers aren't necessarily what exactly is going to be built in each one of these areas, but the total number has been discounted to allow for variances across the board.
Okay, so essentially the feasible is what the developer says that they're proposing in that particular zone.
Okay. And there are two factors that have come off that between the 20,500 and the 15,000. One of those is 30% in greenfield areas for infrastructure, and the second one is that 22% across the board development chance.
Okay. In the first part of the table, you've got the high density residential here. In almost every area of high density residential in this district is located in a perfect location for visitor accommodation. Did you take that into account in the
We haven't looked at competing uses for that. Right. We've taken simply the enabled capacity provided for us by council, whether the market is likely to respond and actually produce the product in that area. So it may well be that something like commercial accommodation actually takes up some of the additional enabled capacity, but we haven't actually considered that in terms of our reduction.
I just had a little note on page 17 of your first lot of evidence. You've got a reference to a footnote there which isn't included. Footnote 14. In fact, it's in paragraph 7.3. Mm-hmm. You've got a footnote 14 and there is no footnote 14. And I don't know whether you deleted the footnote and forgot to delete the reference to it or forgot to put the reference in. Two largest contributors to all capacity in the district is Remarkables Park and Jack's Point. It's 4,500 in one and 3,700 in the other. What allowance have you made for the high proportion of homes in this district being used solely by non-residents?
rationale for none. And although unoccupied dwellings were a decreasing proportion of, in the one group were actually increasing proportion in the white people. Mm-hmm. So that was taken into account in the numbers in terms of the final demand that was assessed, and that so it's an increasing proportion within Waikato.
So you've said that demand is 30% higher or 40% higher?
Yes.
Does it allow for that?
It was a nominal figure that was provided by rationale, but it was a component of the 9,500 that was required by 2048 and an increasing proportion of that was
within. Right. But the adverse consequences of overzoning, well, it was in relation to industrial land, would have been a bit clear, but can you tell me on residential as well?
I think some of the possible issues have even been raised in some of the questions. One of the key concerns with overzoning of with green field land or land in more peripheral locations is the impact that has on redevelopment potential. So the more land you rezone, empty sites are easier to develop than ones that have existing buildings on. And even though we've taken into account an appropriate profit margin when looking at the redevelopment potential in these areas, the market is always going to go with the easiest. And the more land you zone outside of those potential redevelopment areas, the lower the chance you have of redevelopment in that area. There are balancing factors within that. That is, that if the demand is simply for apartments in an area and nobody wants the land that's been rezoned, then you'll still get that development because it'll be indicated in the market that that's less risk because the demand is sitting there. So there are some mitigating factors in terms of the risks of overzoning in Queenstown, because there is a significant level of demand for lower priced product. There's a significant level of demand from, especially for service workers and things like that, and their ability to actually be accommodated within Queenstown. So we know that the demand sits there, it's just how much you start to compete with rezoning more and more land outside of that. And that does represent a degree of competition for developers. And they will go for the lowest risk option. So the more you zone outside that, the bigger the impact you have on the risk differential.
So I want is what you're saying that increasing the potential to infill wouldn't have a negative, but increasing the potential for greenfields would.
That's correct.
So we couldn't overzone with medium density, for instance.
Probably not in the Queenstown market at the moment, no. I mean, there is potentially a point at which that balance tips, but that would typically be regulated by the market, where people would be willing to keep a bigger section in a medium density zone because the profit and the return from splitting it up doesn't compensate for the loss of their land. So you find that the market in terms of that infill actually starts to regulate itself to a degree, and it doesn't in the markets that we see. More expensive areas tend to have bigger sections because the compensation for splitting that up with the owners.
Or if you see, or respective covenants don't allow it anyway.
Absolutely. And so your problem is primarily from rezoning too much greenfield. It's the same with most markets. The more you zone of clean land, as it were, that can be redeveloped with lower risk, the less you're going to have people knock down buildings and redevelop. the same thing as industrial, if you have to buy this piece of land that's already got an existing building that's been actually knocked down, as opposed to Harrisonville, where you've got a piece of land, the more you provide that empty land, the less you can get your income.
One other question, and that's about the choices of accommodation available. Is there any enlightenment that you can offer us whether or not the selection of housing types available is adequate in the location that they're provided? Because in this area, it seems to me, Greenfield is a good example. You know, how can we get into this?
I think in terms of the appropriateness of the level of product in each one of those areas, it's driven at the moment by price. So a lot of the preferences that we generally see in other markets aren't necessarily at the same proportions that we see in Queensland, simply because there will be an acceptance of a product based on price rather than preference. So people would actually locate and would statistically want to be in a standalone home on an 800 square metre site, are much more willing to accept a higher density, not a high density necessarily, but a high density product in this particular market. So the acceptance in these particular areas are so much dictated by price at this particular point, rather than what people generally expect. So their choices have been skewed to a certain degree. And that's not necessarily bad, because a lot of the preference demand is for standalone product and doesn't produce an environment that's actually conducive to a high standard of living and a lot of cost. Commercial office and industrial planning. I've also provided evidence in relation to commercial office activities, being commercial activities that take place in professional offices, and industrial activities, specifically in relation to medium and long term. Medium and long term is defined by the NPS, urban development capacity, medium development being 3 to 10 years, and long term being beyond that period. And the land requirements for those activities. One correction I would like to make to my evidence in chief is the exclusion of the NPS UDC long-term buffer of 15% to the residential land capacity. My evidence outlined that there was sufficient industrial land to 2030, and that's typically to the end of that year. With an overall district demand of 47 hectares of land and a supply of 52 hectares, when considering the 15% buffer, these numbers converge with an overall demand of 54 hectares and a current supply of 52. This would suggest that the district has sufficient industrial land capacity to the beginning of 2030. Over the past 15 years, the district's commercial and industrial environment has seen substantial changes. As the district matures, a greater level of business activity generated within the district is retained. This has led to substantial levels of growth, 150% in employment, far exceeding the national average of 31% over the same period. This has also led to a changing composition, and the economy increasingly provides the activities to service its own population of visitors. This has collectively resulted in a 200% increase in industrial and commercial office employment. These changes have placed pressure on the district's business land supply and have resulted in rapidly increasing business land prices and inappropriate levels of competition within zones. Over the past decade, prices for industrial land have exceeded $1,000 a square metre, due in part to increasing industrial demand and the fact that 40% of the district's commercial office consents over the past 5 years have occurred in industrial zones. So the Waka City Ward accommodates a greater proportion to population of employment, The Wanaka Ward has seen increased retention over 15 years, especially pre-2008, and continues to expand as a business location as well as residential base. The Queenstown Town Centre, Frankton and Wanaka Town Centre continue to accommodate the majority of commercial activity growth and growth, with Frankton experiencing the vast majority of industrial growth. Existing capacity for projected growth requirements are based on the availability of vacant business land. Under the PDP, it is estimated that vacant commercial land makes up over 70 hectares, 47 hectares in Waitsipu and 25 hectares in Wanaka, while there is 51.5 hectares of vacant industrial land. Looking forward, employment growth would suggest a 100% increase in commercial office and industrial employment over 30 years, and the need to accommodate 10,000 additional employees in the district's business environment. Taking into account changing employment to land ratios by sector and a latent demand for 11 hectares, it is expected that the district will require 92 hectares of industrial land by 2048 to accommodate the expected growth and changes to sector land requirements. Similarly, commercial office activity will require 18 hectares of commercial land at an average of 2 stories across the district by 2048. This also takes into consideration a minimal degree of intensification of existing activity. When considering the level of vacant business, not considering any potential redevelopment of existing premises, and allowing for the 15% long-term buffer under the NBS as outlined above, it is expected that while both activities will have sufficient capacity for the life of the PDP, industrial land capacity is likely to be absorbed by the beginning of 2030, and the level of commercial land, with the total demand for commercial land outlined in the evidence of the PDP, we took into account retail and commercial services, will be sufficient through the 20-year period to 2038, with a potential shortfall in the latter 10 years, to 2048, of just over 17 hectares. It is important to note that while the underprovision of business land represents significant risks to the district's economy and its efficient operation, so too does a significant oversupply. Rezoning material levels of business land not required for significant periods can lead to inappropriate market signals and responses, as well as uncompetitive business environments and reduced propensity for the right investment.
Some of the sort of understanding required here, particularly with respect to the industrial land, is there speculation on industrial land as well?
Not to a degree that we wouldn't expect to see in a standard market. So the issue with industrial land is not necessarily that it's not being used and being held, but the activities that it's being used for. Find that industrial land prices are pushing up, and essentially open non-industrial activities can afford to go on that land. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's actually generating a degree of turnover in the market, where it's not worth speculating on the land, because the activity can generate a significant increase in the land.
I want to follow up on the industrial stuff while it's in the brain. Capacity and occupancy until the beginning of 2030, what kind of industrial activity would likely come to the board, and what sort of lead time do you have to provide the land space to meet that need? In other words, to hit the ground running around 2030. When do you do it, and what for?
I think there are two things that need to be in place for the market to work efficiently. One is the lead time for actual land provision. That is generally a 5 to 10 year lead time, so that businesses can make appropriate decisions. And the second one is to indicate to the market that more land will be made available, so that businesses who make their decisions at a 20 to 30-year time frame, as some businesses do in terms of potential growth, know that there will be more of that land made available, and the council knows that it needs to provide more in the future. So there's both a real and a perceived indicator of the market quality.
Another one about employment, I don't remember what it was you all were saying. Talking about working from home, it's a bit like being able to flat on every house, you know, when it comes to voting capacity. Working from home, what happens in what position now, and what would you expect in the future? I think one of us got a bit more of it than you would expect.
And that's exactly right. We factor in a trend into the data, where we look at the number of businesses that we expect, a certain size that we expect to work from home, and we look at how that's changed over a 15-year period, and then we trend that out. Now you've got one of the things that's driving the latent demand I talk about in terms of the 11 hectares for industrial. The other thing is that activity is not necessarily not already taking place, but it's taking place in an inefficient way. So it may well be that there's even small industrial businesses that are working from home to a degree. There are construction companies that operate out of the house, essentially, for want of better premises. So these activities still occur, but they occur in an inefficient in a way that they can't grow effectively. So there is a propensity in the current market for there to be a higher proportion of home businesses than you would expect in this market. Moving forward, the 11 hectares as indicated for late demand is provided that those businesses are more likely to move out. You need to obviously have a balance with the price of that land. It's the key constraint rather than just the land itself. If you're still going to be charging $1,000 a square metre for industrial, it's unlikely that those fledgling businesses will be able to afford to actually or warrant actually purchasing or renting land at that sort of price. So you need to, two things need to occur. And one is that there needs to be sufficient land, and there needs to be enough provision to stop competing activities that shouldn't be on that land, essentially to drive up the price of that land, to drive up that business.
There's a trend elsewhere with industrial land for churches and movement, and I noticed there are two churches in rural, so I'm afraid it's that small. Does that affect the consensus? Because they have similar requirements for large areas of land and parking, and they don't want to be near any people that can annoy.
It is a factor, community facilities in general that locate on industrial land. Again, that's within those trends. But if you have a large differential between the cost of industrial land and the cost of rural residential land specifically, and you start to get those community services locating more and more on industrial land, and that again is about the whole package of trying to get the balance in each of the markets so that you don't get inappropriate activities occurring.
And I have three more specific ones if I may. This may not be a fair question, but there's some local shopping centres going in at One Hampton Road, and the consent is just being granted for a 10 lot residential subdivision, which I think, you know, that's because of the discretionary activity in the rural zone to do that. But anyway, when you're looking at today's market for residential or today's market for commercial, what's the development chance that market will happen?
There are a lot of factors that go into a specific location. A lot of the development that we've done through the DCM and indeed the business models deal with averages rather than specific locations, so it's difficult to say what the motivation is, and that's why we've separated out those special development zones as they were at the Marketers Park, because they don't always fit into those averages. It's difficult to sort of ascertain what the propensity really is for that development to occur without knowing what they pay for that land and so forth.
It's interesting because I thought maybe this would be another indicator of creating options for speculation. But it leads on to my next question, which was looking at the zoning available for commercial activity. There doesn't seem to be many. There don't seem to be many zones in the hierarchy available, and I was going to ask you if you wanted to comment on that. Or is that not the right time?
No,
Okay, go for it.
I think from an economic point of view, the types of provisions around those zones are very important. The variety of zones, I think you'll find that the market is quite flexible and probably too flexible in terms of finding loopholes within those zones. As we find, as I say, 40% of commercial consents in industrial zones over the last eight years. I don't know if a wider variety of business zones is better. I think you want to provide flexibility within those zones, but you don't want to be too, you don't want specific provisions too specific in each location. You want to give the market an opportunity to actually grow. So my preference generally is for less zones with firm provision without the leaving the different types of activity in each of those zones. It is appropriate in industrial locations to have a degree of ancillary office provision, simply for efficiencies, but that level is generally restricted either to a percentage of the primary activity or to a certain size.
And my final one, which I think is another, is that in the Jack Point special zone is an area that's vacant at the moment that's set aside, I think it's called community.
Village activity.
Yes, village activity. Are you familiar with that point?
I'm familiar with
that
area.
What's the future of a piece of land like that?
No, not at this stage. But the future, it is appropriate, obviously, to provide the immediate services for any given area, and there's potential for a larger population base, obviously, in that location that may service a slightly wider area. If it's not going to
I was looking at it because it's so close to Coburn, and the issue on the table was, that was raised was what other ancillary activities do you need in Coburn, and what is the risk of, say, the cafe, the stunning industrial cafe in Coburn, for example, dragging everybody over the state highway from that point in the village activities that then. It could happen.
Yes,
absolutely.
Thank you. I think that's
me.
Thank you,
Mr. Just following on from some of those questions about the commercial activities and the range of zones, it appears that there's a number of places in the district where, if you like, office or similar activities have bled out of the commercial centres. At Frankton, we've got examples of submissions for dentists, consultants, I think two consultants, in residential properties adjoining across the road from the local shopping centre, and then in Gorge Road between the town centre zone. And what's the business mixed use, but presently is a furniture shop and stuff. There's a mixture of physiotherapy and those sorts of offices. Is that an indication that we're actually not providing adequately for those sort of service-type activities, if you like?
I think it's probably more of an indication of the ease of locating in residential facilities for these businesses. They typically will take the path of least resistance, and if it's offered to them in concentric circles, as it were, for another activity, then they'll take it. And you see that in every market in New Zealand, where you have typically a town centre and got other types of activities that have been allowed to accommodate it, and eventually, if you don't have appropriate growth to fill that, to backfill that section, you've got to leave the activity from the centre. And once you have that leave now, the activity from the centre, you really get quite the idea of the zero risk of it, and no longer competes effectively with those other locations.
So, in terms of the council's strategy on the Greenstone Town Centre, that it should be focused there and there should be a strong edge to it. Mm-hmm. Is that your view of it, that strong edge is necessary?
I think it's paramount to keep that vibrancy. I mean, there's a unique asset, a lot of vibrancy driven by visitors, anyway, visitors from outside the region. So you're always going to have a degree of vibrancy, but to keep that throughout the year, and to keep those businesses operating effectively throughout the year, you do need to keep that hard line around the periphery. You need to keep that activity centralised.
Okay. Now, if you do that there, does that mean that there should be some limitation on activities? Say a frequent.
I look specifically at the store.
I'm not meaning the frequent, I'm meaning frequent in the broader sense.
Sure.
The three or four, what's the way you have, you want to count up shopping centres that there are there now.
If we're looking at the broader level, then my preference would be that there was a restriction on any other potential franking. In terms of commercial office especially, it's my position that I believe that the larger commercial office, the office of 250-400 square metres, should be central. This is very low. Because they generate a degree of profile that's required for that centre to operate effectively and compete at a greater than regional level, which is what Queenstown needs to do given its increasing resident population and its increasing employment. It is no longer just supplying visitors, it is no longer just supplying jobs for local servicing, it's actually getting to the point where it needs to compete for activity that's wider than just the region.
That raises the question then also whether, if we're concerned about offices, we should equally be concerned with the trade within the office, not just in that interim, but the business that you stand for. That your view there too?
It's my view that there are a limited number of significant office businesses that are located in Queenstown, and in order to make the most in terms of the agglomeration benefits of those, they should be located in the Queenstown Town Centre.
What about the business which is not much more than a home occupation? And I have to admit, I do offer home occupations. But there are a number, I know, that where it may be two people operating from the house, so it ceases to be home occupation, just they're not living there. Is there a small level where it's not actually owned for Fecal Town Centre because those businesses would never locate there either?
Yes. Effectively, you need to provide that place with
Is there a scale? I seem to recall, I think it was in the business zone evidence, you gave some evidence on the maximum amount of commercial office space in some zones. I'm just wondering whether, if we're dealing with that smaller end, is there a maximum, if you would allow them, is there a maximum floor space that you might? Okay.
We looked at, specifically, I've looked at something like that in Taupo, but it's an area outside the town centre called the KTHD area. And the evidence there was that these businesses that were home, essentially home businesses, still wanted closeness to the centre, but wouldn't otherwise be able or willing to pay for commercial activity in the centre. We looked at that, and rather than actually the floor space, it was the number of employees to fix that around to employees.
Three full-time equivalent.
Yes.
So in this system we could assume the same, but scale of two. The two full-time equivalents wouldn't actually be contrary to the commercial strategy, it wouldn't undermine it.
I don't think that. I think you need to provide that level of flexibility for the development of those businesses as well as those businesses that service a number of localised.
Yes. Yes.
You can have a title wrap up one because I just want to go right back to the beginning. Mr. Osborne, have you done these dwelling capacity and people in modelling together, either the MPS city elsewhere than or also in Queenstown?
We've done obviously the SUPC model for Auckland, and we're currently doing some classes.
That's really the sort of thing I was hoping to explore with you, because the business could well turn out to be an odd market compared to most parts of New Zealand, especially in terms of speculation. And the high holiday home, so you know, the non-occupancy, the two together are kind of intriguing, aren't they? But I did want to ask you about the model and in your familiarity with it as a method. As you evolve it, what do you think you would do to improve it or to calibrate it? Because it seems to me that these are two very unusual cases you've done so far.
I think we would look at, we would make it, as we move forward, we would make it dynamic in terms of that it currently looks at a moment in time. As you move forward and as you provide more supply, some of those factors change. For example, very specifically, you have a decrease in the value of your improving value on properties that could potentially increase the level of feasibility to some of those. At the same time, if you continue to have a speculative market and nothing changes there, then you get those demand values driving it up and up until you reach a tipping point where you will be reasonable, because it will be worth the rest of the market saying, well, our land is so valuable. Should we be sitting here with one unit where we can have 16, and ultimately the tipping point where that just gets developed. That's why I think the EVs takes this long term time frame, is that a lot of those motivations are expected to even out at that point. Then a lot of land back and a lot of speculation actually drops away, and the market is more likely to reach towards equilibrium. Queensland is out of equilibrium at the moment. It's not representative of the competitive market. It's representative of a speculative and international market that's driving demand for residential land. And eventually, you would expect to see factors change, especially on an international level, so that comes back to equilibrium.
Does this market would be subject to the vagaries of New Zealand's own cycle, and then you're saying there's an international cycle, which is not a profession, but interest rates.
Yes, yes. I mean, we've seen that it's a good player in Auckland as well, because the market's so much bigger, it doesn't influence the variables in the
country. That helps, thank you.
Coming back to that issue of redevelopment, we had quite a few issues where people want zoning like rural residential. Are those in areas which potentially could be urban? And this is just a why not, but thinking in the broad sense. Are those, is that wasteful? or should we be encouraging more development in those situations?
There is an economic cost associated with rural residential development that isn't necessarily met by the purchase of that land. And that could well be the loss of productivity of that land, or it could well be the dispersal of activity away from, as we talked about, the redevelopment of existing. The more you rezone and the more provision you make in the greenfield and rural areas, the more you disperse activity in general.
You think that's the rural residential rather than residential?
Even if it's the rural residential, you're taking that demand away from somewhere. You do need to balance that with obviously wanting to be a competitive area for housing in general and for residential lifestyle. You're not going to end up putting everybody in an apartment, for example. You need to provide choice, but it needs to be an appropriate level of choice. So there needs to be a balance between the perceived economic benefits of rezoning more greenfield land and the growth that comes with that, and the inevitable economic costs that come along with that as well. And as I say, those economic costs aren't necessarily met by the purchase of the land. They are at that moment in time. However productive that land is, you're going to have to at least pay for that productivity of land to live there. But moving forward, if you take away all your productive land, you start having greater costs than just that loss.
No, good.
Thank you.
as well, we can be at